batch of gnocchi into simmering water, his hands shaking with fear and tears streaming down his face, as one batch after another failed to meet his expectations. I don't remember the finished product going out, but the chef showed up to work the next day, so I imagine the customer was happy. Another memorable event was the RFK charity tennis tournament. The whole place was taken over by actors, politicians, famous faces, and long-haired Kennedy kids in tuxes and basketball sneakers. Secret Service agents and sniffer dogs combed the kitchen for fissionable material and hidden weapons. I was surprised when they didn't find any. The highlight of the event was a mishap involving honored guest Dina Merrill, sitting near the head of the banquet table with hubby Cliff Robertson. One of our veteran waiters lost control of an entire tray of bubbling tortellini Alfredo, depositing an upended pile of Parmesan-laced heavy cream and pasta directly on Ms. Merrill's coif. There was weeping and rending of garments in the kitchen that night, I can tell you. The offending waiter nearly suicidal with fear, shame, and grief. He was part of a father-son waiting team, Dad having been relegated to running coffee orders for his golden years, and son was despondent. I don't know what he was crying about. It was a union house, after all. As in any large restaurant operation, there were tiny centers of power, fiefdoms, little empires that seemed to exist outside of the normal hierarchy. Johnny was the pastry chef, and his shop, set apart from the main kitchen, was a relative fortress of solitude and civility in a sea of chaos. I worked with Johnny every once in a while just to escape the heat and frenzied pace of the main kitchen, and because the quality of life was significantly better in Johnny's tiny kingdom, I could, thanks to Chef Bernard at CIA, throw together a decent souffle when called upon to do so, and I was good at decorating and inscribing cakes, for which there was a lot of call. The Johnny crew consisted of a taciturn Swiss who worked three other jobs and always looked ready to die from fatigue, and an aged ex-Wehrmacht corporal with dyed red hair and mustache who loved to regale me with stories of Weimar-era perversions. "They would feed the girls bananas," he said once, leering and winking as he described a purported club for coprophiles. "Hitler, Goering, yeah, Goering, they would go to these places." Daytime with Gianni involved a lot of very fast, very hard work, mostly production, cake assembly, wrapping of the ever-present Wellingtons and pastry dough, rolls, pastries, stacks of crepes for Crispella, cookies, the sectioning of fruit for later dipping in caramelized sugar. All the while, Johnny urged us on with cries of, "Cha, cha, via, let's go!" But the atmosphere in Gianni Land was remarkably happy-go-lucky. At the beginning of the workday, a waiter would appear with an urn of steaming hot espresso, and we would actually sit down for a nice demitasse, accompanied by homemade sticky buns. Even in the middle of full-bore production, Johnny found time to hurl profiteroles at the skaters 64 flights down in the Rock Center rink, all of us having a good laugh when he scored a direct hit. And Johnny was a skilled raconteur. His romantic adventures and misadventures made for much entertainment. Though married, he was relentless in his pursuit of every woman in the restaurant. Most of them looked like whichever was the uglier of Cagney and Lacey, the later episodes when they bulked up to cruiserweights. He was always befuddled when one of them would resist his affections. "So I say to this girl, I bring you out to nice dinner, which I pay, and I drive you a nice car, a Buick, and you don't want to fuck me? I don't understand." He was kind of charming, totally untrustworthy, conspiratorial, possessing mysterious juice with the ownership, able to operate completely outside the normal chain of command. What I loved about Johnny, though, was that at the stroke of four, when the day shift ended, we all sat down and had a lovely meal of prosciutto, arugula, sliced tomato, and mozzarella on fresh-baked Italian bread, often accompanied by a nice bottle of red wine and more espresso. Where Johnny got this stuff, I have no idea, particularly since edible food was decidedly not a perk enjoyed by the rest of the staff and kitchen crew. In the main kitchen, and for the floor staff, the family meal was uniformly awful. Hunks of silver skin covered breast flaps of veal, not even braised until tender, just poached gray with a few slices of onion, accompanied by leftover pellets of gluey steam table rice or two-day-old pasta. There might be some inattentively chopped fried peppers and onions if you were lucky. The big event was when one of the cooks was allowed to thaw out a few boxes of freezer-burned sweet sausages, lovingly referred to by the cooks as pingas. This was everybody's favorite meal, and the excitement and enthusiasm with which my comrades-in-arms scarfed these things down was truly tragic to watch. Compared to raft day, however, the pingas were indeed a luxury. The room prep area always had three gigantic steam kettles filled with a dark, all-purpose stock, simmering endlessly under a raft of ground beef, meat scraps, chicken bones, turkey carcasses, the trimmings of vegetables, carrot peelings, and eggshells. When stuck for gruel, the cooks would actually skim this floating compost off the surface, toss it with a little tomato sauce and dead pasta, and serve it to the inexplicably grateful staff. It was but one of many food crimes I witnessed and took part in during my time at the Rainbow Room. During service, Chateaubriands, big hunks of beef tenderloin for two, If ordered well done, were routinely thrown into the deep fryer until crispy, then tossed into an oven to incinerate further until pickup. Everything was seared off in advance. When the expediter called for the order, one simply heated the plate, vegetable garnish and all, under a salamander, drizzled a little sauce over the item, and sent it out to the unsuspecting rubes. Any magic I'd imagined about a big-time fancy New York kitchen was replaced by a grim pride in creative expediency and the technical satisfaction of being fast enough to keep up, getting away with trickery, deception, and disguise. An ounce of sauce covers a multitude of sins, as we used to say. I didn't care what atrocities we were inflicting on a credulous public, lulled into docility by our spectacular view, our swank appointments, big band, and high prices. I was putting up serious numbers and holding my own with the best of the lifers. I could destroy and serve a nice piece of veal or Dover sole as fast, if not faster, than any of them. I was working every station in the kitchen, keeping up with the ugliest, meanest 20-year veterans anyone back in P-Town had even dreamed of. I was a line stud, an all-around guy, a man's man. I was on top of the world. On the other hand, I was tired. By now, I was going in to work at 7:30 a.m. and working straight through until midnight almost every day. As soon as I'd finish up in the luncheon club or the pastry shop, the chef seemed always to be wanting to take me aside and squeeze me for another night on the hotline. After weeks of this and still not taking home over $200 on payday, I finally balked. Unable to convince me, the chef summoned me for a private chat with the boss, a sinister Italian with yet another thick accent. The boss looked up at me from his desk, fixing me in a shark-like gaze, and said, "I understand you don't want to help us tonight by staying late." "I was tired," I explained, "and in love," hoping to appeal to that romantic Mediterranean nature I'd read and heard about. "My girlfriend," I said, "I don't see her anymore, and I miss her. I have," I added, "a life outside of this place." I went on to describe going home each night to a sleeping girl, rolling exhausted into the sheets, still stinking from work, and how I arose at 6 with the girl still asleep, never exchanging so much as a word before leaving for work again for yet another double. This was no good for a relationship, I said. "Look at me," said my boss, as if the nice suit and the haircut and the desk explained everything. "I am married 10 years to my wife," he smiled. "I work all the time. I never see her. She never sees me." He paused now to show me some teeth, his eyes growing more penetrating and a little scary. "We are very happy." What my boss meant by this little glimpse into his soul, I have no idea, but he impressed me. I worked the double, figuring maybe this was what was required, total dedication. Forget the loved ones. Forget the outside world. There is no life other than this life. I didn't spend much time trying to figure it out. The man scared me. Years later, I got another perspective on things. I opened the post to see a photo of my old boss's wife draped over the awning of a Chinese restaurant on the Upper East Side. She'd apparently performed a double gainer from the window of her high-rise apartment and not quite made it to the pavement, so I guess she wasn't that happy after all. All in all, I was at the Rainbow Room for about a year and a half before elections for shop steward came around. When one of the garde-manger guys suggested I run for the position, I was only too happy to give it a shot. Luis, after all, was a disgrace. I was by now an accepted, even popular member of the Rainbow Room crew, a dues-paying, card-carrying union member. And as a young, semi-educated firebrand with a couple of years of college under my belt, a fine private school vocabulary, a culinary degree, and a predilection for left-wing politics, I assumed I'd be a welcome addition to the restaurant workers' union. A young man with the workers' interests at heart, a fighter for the downtrodden, an activist who could get things done. Someone who could lead and inspire, help to achieve better working conditions and benefits for one of the largest union shops in the country. Certainly, the union biggies would be pleased to see the dipsomaniacal Luis replaced by a young go-getter like me. And I wanted to see the mysterious contract, the Rosetta Stone of our union benefits. According to our little union books, any union member could inspect this important document at any time, yet none of us had ever seen it. Our rights as employees of the Rainbow Room, as negotiated by our duly elected representatives and officers of the union, remained a matter of rumor and conjecture. I wanted to clap eyes on this thing, so I ran. I won handily. Luis, strangely, didn't even put up a fight. I figured that my shanking him with a meat fork had something to do with his reluctance to mount a campaign, but I was wrong about that. After a quick vote, I was the shop steward. You'd think the union would be happy about this development, or at least curious, with an energetic young organizer in their midst. I scheduled a meeting with the union president, looking forward to commiserating about the imperialist jackboot on the necks of the workers and the struggle against the controllers of the means of production. When I finally sat down with the president of Local 6, yet another Italian with a thick accent, he was oddly unenthusiastic. He looked up sleepily at me from behind the desk of his dark office as if I were a delivery boy bringing him a sandwich. When I asked him if I could, as shop steward, familiarize myself with the contract, so that I might better serve our members, the president fiddled with his cufflinks and said, I seem to have temporarily misplaced it. It was clear from his inflection and posture that he didn't give a fuck whether I believed him or not. After a few more minutes of near total silence and zero enthusiasm on the president's part, I got the hint and skulked back to work empty-handed. The next day, someone from management came by and made an unusually frank suggestion. If I wanted a long, successful, and most important, healthy career in the restaurant business, perhaps I should step down and let that nice Luis continue his good works as shop steward. It would, I was assured, be in everybody's best interest. He didn't have to tell me twice. I made a few discreet inquiries of a few trusted veterans and quickly resigned from my newly elected position. Luis once again picked up the reins of power as if he'd known all along what would happen. I didn't raise a stink and a few weeks later left the Rainbow Room entirely. I'd seen on the waterfront, and I learned fast. The Happy Time. In 1981, my good friend from high school and later Provincetown, Sam G., became the chef de cuisine of Work Progress. A once trendy restaurant on Spring Street in Soho, the place had fallen on hard times. It was now under new ownership, and Sammy, one of us, was in charge of putting the kitchen together. It was what a lot of us had been waiting for, our own thing, and the call went out to all our old cronies. From Provincetown came Dimitri, finally enticed from off-season exile at the tip of the Cape by excited promises of culinary history in the making. I would share sous chef responsibilities with my mentor. From West Village saloons, we recruited every young, pot-smoking, head-banging hooligan we'd ever worked with, filling their heads with dreams of glory. We're forming like a rock and roll band, man, an all-star group of culinary superstars, kind of like Blind Faith. We're going to tear a new asshole into the New York restaurant scene. We fancied ourselves the most knowledgeable and experienced young Turks in town, and our hearts were filled with hope and the promise of enviable futures. We thought we were the only cooks in New York who could quote from the La Russe Gastronomique and Repertoire de la Cuisine, who knew who Vatel, Carême, and Escoffier were, what Bocuse, Verger, and Gerard were doing across the water, and we were determined to replicate their successes and their fame. There was no one on the horizon we could see who could touch us. Okay, there was one guy, Patrick Clark. Patrick was the chef of the Red Hot Odeon in nascent Tribeca, a neighborhood that seemed not to have existed until Patrick started cooking there. We followed his exploits with no small amount of envy. Born under a broiler, people said. He's screwing Gale Green, claimed others. There were a lot of stories, most of them, like most chefs' gossip, apocryphal. But what we did know about Patrick for sure impressed the hell out of us. He was kind of famous. He was big and black. Most important, he was an American, one of us, not some cheese-eating surrender specialist froggy. Patrick Clark, whether he would have appreciated it or not, was our hometown hero, our Joe DiMaggio, a shining example that it could be done. As we assembled for menu planning sessions, the process of getting our kitchen up and running began. We formed in our already dope-fogged brains a plan, a notional movement even, that would sweep away all the moribund old European chefs and dazzle the world with our new American act, as soon as we figured out what that was. We even planned a hit, a sort of Night of the Sicilian Vespers thing where we'd straighten them all out in one fell swoop. Back in those days, the older European chefs, Saltner and his generation, would attend an annual chef's race, a downhill ski event at Hunter Mountain, where contestants would bomb the slopes in full kitchen whites, toques strapped to their chins. Our plan was to lurk in the woods at the side of the trail, also dressed in whites, but luridly adorned with skull and crossbones painted in chicken blood. We'd intercept the geezer contingent as they waddled down the slope and whack them rudely with our ski poles, maybe bombard them with foie gras. We were younger and, we assumed, better skiers, so we'd have no problem fending off any counterattack. We believed this would be a bold and memorable way to announce ourselves to the world, until the coke ran out and our enthusiasm with it. I still laugh out loud when I remember our earnest strategy sessions. However cruel and pointless and stupid the idea might have been, it was a measure of our faith in ourselves. Saltner, of course, was a god to us. The idea of whacking him upside the head with my ski poles and running over his rossignols with my rented skis was always unthinkable and lucid. The new owners of Work Progress, our putative masters, were a textbook example of people who should never own a restaurant. There were two brothers, one half-smart, the other genuinely dumb, who'd gotten a few bucks from mommy and daddy along with their partner, a slightly more cognizant college friend who could actually read a P&L sheet and crunch a few numbers. Their principal business was investing in off-Broadway shows. As this apparently wasn't unprofitable enough, they'd chosen the restaurant business as a way to lose their money more quickly and assuredly. From the get-go, Sammy, Dimitri, and I managed to intimidate the partners right out of their own restaurant. At every suggestion from this novice triumvirate, we'd snort with contempt, roll our eyes with world-weary derision, and shoot down whatever outrage, be it tablecloths, flatware, or menu items, they'd come up with. We were merciless in our naked contempt for every idea they came in with, and we outsnobbed, outmaneuvered, and outbullied them at every turn. As the three principal masterminds of this culinary utopia were all P-Town veterans, we constructed our downstairs kitchen along familiar lines, as a faithful recreation of the kitchens we'd grown up in, insular, chaotic, drenched in drugs and alcohol, and accompanied constantly by loud rock and roll music. When the restaurant opened, we'd begin every shift with a solemn invocation of the first moments of Apocalypse Now, our favorite movie. Emulating the title sequence, we'd play the soundtrack album, choppers coming in low and fast, the whir of the blades getting louder and more unearthly, and just before Jim Morrison kicked in with the first few words, "This is the end, my brand new friend, the end," we'd soak the entire range top with brandy and ignite it, causing a huge napalm-like fireball to rush up into the hoods, just like in the movie when the tree line goes up. If our boobish owners and newly hired floor staff weren't already thoroughly spooked by our antics, then they were by this act. We fought all the time, Sam, Dimitri, and I. Waving our cookbooks at each other, we'd squabble endlessly over the correct way to prepare certain dishes. We teased, poked, prodded, sulked, conspired, and competed. We wanted to be the best. We wanted to be different, but at the same time, correct. We yearned to bring honor to our clan, and in that vein, we came up with the looniest, most ambitious menu our superheated, endorphin-overloaded brains could agree on, a sort of greatest hits of our checkered careers so far collection. French classics sat side by side with Portuguese squid stew. My Tanjan's humble salade de tomate, dishes we lifted out of cookbooks, stolen from other chefs, remembered seeing on TV. There were Wellfleet oysters on the half shell, oysters Mitchum in honor of Howard. There was a pasta dish from Mario's, a sort of tagliarini with trail mix and anchovies, as I recall. Scallops and sorrel sauce from Bocuse, maybe. Calves liver with raspberry vinegar sauce, swordfish with black beans and white rice, pompano en papillote, my mother's creme renversée. We were high all the time, sneaking off to the walk-in at every opportunity to conceptualize. Hardly a decision was made without drugs. Pot, quaaludes, cocaine, LSD, psilocybin mushrooms soaked in honey and used to sweeten tea, secanol, tuinol, speed, codeine, and increasingly heroin, which we'd send a Spanish-speaking busboy over to Alphabet City to get. We worked long hours and took considerable pride in our efforts, the drugs we thought having little effect on the end product. That was what the whole life we were in was about, we believed, to work through the drugs, the fatigue, the lack of sleep, the pain, to show no visible effects. We might be tripping out on blotter acid, sleepless for 3 days and halfway through a bottle of Stoli, but we were professionals, goddammit. We didn't let it affect our line work, and we were happy, truly happy, like Henry V's lucky few, a band of brothers, ragged, slightly debauched warriors who anticipated nothing less than total victory, an Agincourt of the mind and stomach. We were pretty busy initially, and along with the young protégés who held us in something like awe, Sam, Dimitri, and I would work all day and late into the night. When the restaurant closed, we'd take over the bar, drinking Cristal, which we'd buy at cost, and running fat rails of coke from one end of the bar to the other, then crawling along on all fours to snort them. The cuter and more degenerate members of the floor staff would hang with us, so there was a lot of humping in the dry goods area and on the banquettes, 50-pound flour sacks being popular staging areas for after-work copulation. We'd bribe the doorman and security people of all the local nightclubs and rock and roll venues with steak sandwiches and free snacks, so that after we'd finished with our pleasures at the Work Progress bar, we'd bounce around from club to club without waiting online or paying admission. A squadron of punk rocker, junkie guitar heroes ate for free at Work Progress, so we got free tickets and backstage passes to the Mud Clubs, CBGB, Tier 3, Hurrah, Club 57, and so on. And when the clubs closed, it was off to after hours, where we'd drink and do more drugs until, weather permitting, we'd hit the 7 o'clock train to Long Beach. We'd finish the last of our smack on the train, then pass out on the beach. Whichever one of us woke from the nod would roll the others over to avoid an uneven burn. When we finally arrived back at work, sand in our hair, we looked tanned, rested, and ready. We considered ourselves a tribe. As such, we had a number of unusual customs, rituals, and practices all our own. If you cut yourself in the Work Progress kitchen, tradition called for maximum spillage and dispersion of blood. One squeezed the wound till it ran freely, then hurled great gouts of red spray on the jackets and aprons of comrades. We loved blood in our kitchen. If you dinged yourself badly, it was no disgrace. We'd stencil a little cut-out shape of a chef knife under your station to commemorate the event. After a while, you'd have a little row of these things, like a fighter pilot. The house cat, a mouse killer, got her own stencil, a tiny mouse shape, sprayed on the wall by her water bowl, signifying confirmed kills. Departing cooks and favored waiters on their last day of employment were invited to nail their grotty work shoes to a wall of fame by Sammy's cellar office. As time went on, row after row of moldering work boots, shoes, and sneakers were pounded into the wall, a somewhat grim reminder of departed friends. On slow nights, and there were, disconcertingly, a growing number of these, we'd have fun with food color and sweet dough. Dimitri, it turned out, was remarkably adept at crafting lifelike fingers, toes, and sexual organs from basic ingredients. He'd fashion frighteningly realistic severed thumbs, skin rudely shredded at one end, bone fragments made from leek white projecting from the wound, and we'd leave these things around for unsuspecting waiters and managers to find. A waiter would open a reach-in the morning to find a leaking, torn fingertip, band-aid still attached, pinioned to a slice of Wonder Bread with a frilled toothpick. A floor manager would be called down to the kitchen in the middle of a dinner shift to find one of us standing by a bloody cutting board, red-smeared side towel wrapped around a hand, and as they approached, one of Dimitri's grisly fingers would drop onto his foot. We experimented constantly, finding to our delight that not only did the sweet dough look like flesh when shaped and colored correctly, but it drew flies like the real thing. Left overnight at room temperature, Dimitri's fake digits could develop into a truly horrifying spectacle. Eventually, when every member of the staff was thoroughly inured to the sight of a severed, fly-covered penis in the urinal or finding a bloody finger in his apron pocket, we moved on to even greater atrocities. One night, with his full cooperation, we stripped Dimitri naked, spattered and filled his ears, nose, and mouth with stage blood, and wrapped him in saran wrap before helping him into a chest freezer in the dark rear storage area of the restaurant, his limbs arranged in an unnaturally contorted pose, as if he'd been rudely dumped there post-mortem. We then called the manager on the intercom, asking first if he'd seen Dimitri. We hadn't seen him in hours, we explained, and we were worried. Then we asked the poor bastard if he'd be kind enough to grab a box of shrimp out of the freezer for us, as we were short-handed, Dimitri being missing and all, and four tables going out at once. I think you can imagine what the manager experienced, hurrying back to the dank corner of the cellar, a single bare light bulb illuminating the chest freezer. He lifts the lid, only to find the nude, fish-belly-white, blood-spattered corpse of our missing comrade staring up at him with dead eyes through a thin layer of plastic wrap, the beginnings of a light frost under the film making the already gruesome scene even more terrifyingly real. We ended up having to give the guy a shot of ammonia inhaler. His knees buckled, and he was unable to return to work for over an hour. Dimitri, of course, caught a terrible cold for his efforts, but it was worth it. The manager left shortly after, and he didn't bother to nail up his work boots on our wall of fame. But we cared little for managers or owners, or customers for that matter. By now, unsurprisingly, our restaurant was rapidly failing. I began to see for the first time what I would later recognize as failing restaurant syndrome, an affliction that causes owners to flail about looking for a quick fix, a fast master stroke that will turn things around, cure all their ills, reverse the already irreversible trend towards insolvency. We tried New Orleans brunch, complete with Dixieland band. We tried a prefix menu, a Sunday night buffet. We advertised. We hired a publicist. Each successive brainstorm was more counterproductive than the one before. All of this floundering about and concept tinkering only further demoralized an already demoralized staff. When the paychecks started bouncing and the vendors started to put us on COD, the owners called in the restaurant consultants. Even then, we knew what that meant. The consultants usually arrived just ahead of the repo men and the marshals. It was the death knell. We had tried, we had failed. Naturally, we held the owners responsible. It was a tough spot. The ambience was no good. The music in the dining room sucked. The waiters weren't well trained, and we tried to console ourselves with the usual excuses. But the truth was, we just weren't good enough. Our food, while charming to some, was unappealing to most. We did not commit seppuku. Sam and Dimitri stayed on, determined to go down with the ship. But my cousin had hooked me up with my very first chef's job, at a spanking new but already troubled boîte in the theater district, and I jumped at the offer. I felt bad about leaving my friends behind, and I had the beginnings of a very nasty little heroin habit from all the dope I'd been sniffing. But hey, I was about to become a chef. Chef of the Future. I was 22 years old and the chef of a new theater district restaurant on West 46th Street, Restaurant Row. As would become something of a recurring theme in my career, I was following close on the heels of the departed opening chef, who turned out, it was said, to be an alcoholic psychopath, a compulsive liar, and a thief. I, it was hoped, was the solution to the problem, a fresh-faced, eager kid just out of culinary school who would respond to my novice owner's wishes and was willing and capable of turning an already bad situation around. Tom H., as the place was called, was a classic vanity boutique-type operation. Named for one of its owners, it was a small glass and crushed velvet jewel box of a place on the ground floor of a three-story brownstone. Tom, the principal owner, had been a clothing designer, and with Fred, his longtime lover, had been a popular host to his many famous friends in the theater, fashion, music, and film industries. Tom and Fred were the beloved hosts of hundreds of well-remembered dinner parties. They were genuinely lovely, intelligent, warm-hearted, and funny older guys who cooked well, had impeccable taste, and were considered, rightly, to be wonderful, charming, and entertaining hosts, naturals, it had been said, for the restaurant business, especially a restaurant in the heart of the theater district where they knew and were liked by so many. Tom was famous among his wide circle for his meatloaf, his jalapeno corn pudding, and Fred for his dill bread and jalapeno jelly. And in spite of the fact that meatloaf was a tad lower in the hierarchy of menu items than I would have liked, I was still the chef, and nominally in charge of my own kitchen. I was not unhappy about continuing with these cherished signature dishes. The meatloaf got a lot of press from friendly gossip columnists, and in the first months of Tom's, limos full of famous people lined up outside to try the stuff. John and Angelica Houston, Liv Ullman, Jose Quintero, Glenda Jackson, Cheetah Rivera, Lauren Bacall come to mind. The entire staff outside the kitchen was gay, a situation I was entirely comfortable with after Vassar, Provincetown, the West Village, and Soho. The gossipy, self-effacing, overtly queer atmosphere was not only fun, but in many ways completely in line with the gossipy, self-effacing, overtly depraved world of chefs and cooks. The waiters and bartenders could always be counted on for funny personal anecdotes of sexual misadventures, particularly as this was the early 80s, and they were always willing to share in hilarious and clinical detail their excesses of the previous night. Our bar crowd, however, the guys you saw when you first walked in the door at Tom's, were almost uniformly like their hosts, older gay men. The floor staff and bartenders, far younger and hunkier, uncharitably referred to the restaurant as a wrinkle room, and made much fun of the somewhat sad, even desperate longings of some of our clientele. We may have been in the gossip columns a lot, and dinners, when I arrived, were still fairly busy for pre- and post-theater. But Tom's was decidedly not hot, not with an average age of 60 staking out the bar making goo-goo eyes at the bartender. We were busy for pre-theater, a mad rush to get them in and get them out in time to make curtain, followed by nearly 3 hours of complete inactivity. The far end of West 46th Street in 1982 was Nowheresville. Only predators, guardian angels, and junkies seemed to walk by. The whole crew, kitchen floor, and even Tom and Fred would hang out and gossip to stay amused, hoping for a second pop when the shows let out near 11. Work progress was by now only a few weeks from complete ruin, so I began peeling away a few key men. Dimitri became my sous chef, and a couple of other cooks and dishwashers followed me uptown as well. I did my best to punch up the menu, putting on some beloved American regional comfort dishes I thought in keeping with the meatloaf and jalapeno corn pudding theme. We fooled around with a lot of retro classics like chicken pot pie, fried chicken steak with cream gravy, black-eyed peas and collards, ham steak with red-eye gravy, New England clam chowder, San Francisco chipino, and the like. I did my best to work the line responsibly, spend Tom and Fred's money wisely, and generally behave in such a way as to not offend the delicate sensibilities of my very kindly new masters. But things were already not going as planned. Tom and Fred had taken over the entire building and dropped big money making it over into the bistro of their dreams. They'd purchased a lovely serpentine zinc bar at an auction in France, put in all new equipment, built living quarters, office space, and a small prep kitchen upstairs. It had, I'm sure, cost them a lot of money. But I don't think they were prepared for a sudden requirement that they extend the range hood exhaust vent another 200 feet and 3 floors to project beyond the roof, requiring a new motor the size of a small economy car to provide suction. And there were the bafflers and filters to muffle the damn thing to meet city sound level requirements. Lunch was quiet, and a decent pre-theater followed by a so-so post-theater rush was not enough to pay for rent, food, liquor, labor, power, and all the other hidden and unglamorous expenses of a midtown restaurant. Tom didn't help matters by hovering at the door, peering out into the street in search of a walk-in tray that would never come. The closest we got to that was when one of our aged bar customers got lucky over at the Haymarket, a particularly nasty, mob-run hustler bar over on 8th, who would treat one of their underage, dirty, and potentially vicious pickups to a nice meal. Tom and Fred had taken a lifetime lease on the building. They lived on the top floor, fully intending, I believe, to spend the rest of their lives there. So it pained me to see their dream die in increments, to see the realization dawn with each expensive repair, each slow night, each unforeseen expense, that things were not turning out as hoped. The waiters, not uncharacteristically, joked bitterly about the situation. Where were all of Tom and Fred's friends now, they asked knowingly, now that they were no longer getting comped free meals. But Betty Bacall loves that dish, Tom would protest when I suggested removing a particularly moribund item from the menu. He'd keep certain things on, favorites of celebrity pals, day in and day out, waiting for them to return. But Betty Bacall was not coming to dinner every day, I could have pointed out, nor every week. In fact, she probably wasn't ever coming back. The place was dying. The smell of desperation was in the air. You could detect it halfway down the block, as we were surrounded by equally customer-hungry places. You could see it in Tom's face, and when a few straggling celebrities would on occasion wander through the door, he'd pounce on them like a starved remora. I soldiered on. I didn't know what else to do. Restrained from putting much of my own imprint on the place, and unprepared in any case to offer a viable alternative, I occupied myself with scoring drugs on 9th Avenue, maintaining a nice buzz at the bar, and keeping a stiff upper lip about our declining fortunes. I may have been the chef, but I had in no way learned the chefly arts. There was really no need at Tom's. I was working with friends, so there was no call for the manipulation, intelligence gathering, and detective work of later posts. The place was slow, so the air traffic controller aspects of chef work had yet to come into play. And the food wasn't mine. I came quickly to hate, unjustifiably, Tom's now-not-so-famous meatloaf as an immovable object, and I settled not very happily into a position that was more overpaid line cook than chef. What I learned at Tom's was a sad lesson that has served me well in decades since. I learned to recognize failure. I saw for the first time how two beloved, funny, and popular guys can end up less beloved, not so funny, and much less popular after trying to do nothing more than what their friends told them they were good at. Friendships, I'm sure, were destroyed. Loyal pals stopped coming, causing real feelings of betrayal and embitterment. In the end, I guess, we all let them down. I found a job in the Post and jumped ship at the first opportunity. Rick's Cafe was an even more boneheaded venture, an absolutely idiotic Bogart-themed restaurant on a deserted street in Tribeca, run as a caprice by the near-brainless wife of a successful Greek deli owner. One look at this sinkhole, the faux taverna decor left over from a previous establishment, the framed photos of Bogey and Ingrid Bergman, the always fatal absence of a liquor license, and I should have run for the hills. I could recognize failure when I saw it, but I was desperate to get away from Tom's, and the deli owner paid me cash money from a fat roll in his pocket. It seemed like an okay place to lie low while I looked for a real chef's job. It was a horror. Our purveyors were all sinister Greek jobbers who bought cheap and sold cheap. Our floor staff were the lame, the halt, and the ugly, and our only business was a lunch crowd from nearby city agency offices, cheapskates and well-done eaters all. Dinner? We might as well have been stationed on an ice floe in Antarctica. The whole neighborhood closed down at 6, and as we were the antithesis of hip, and as yet without booze, no sane person would travel out of their way to visit our little bogey brattle museum. I tried to go along with a witless Casablanca concept, a sort of French North African theme, making, I thought, a very nice tagine with couscous like I'd enjoyed in France, merguez, and some southern French Mediterranean dishes. It was clearly hopeless. Even my boss, the deli master, knew. I think he was stoically flushing money down the tubes to keep his wife out of his hair. Things had apparently gotten so grim at Tom's after my departure that Dimitri joined me in my bogey-themed hell. I was now within walking distance of readily available heroin, so I was reasonably satisfied, and Dimitri, while not exactly enjoying the fame and fortune I promised him in P-Town, was soon getting regular blowjobs from one of the Rick's Cafe waitresses. Life was not all bad. I was 3 for 3 from my last 3 restaurants. Fortunately, I was still young, so I could comfortably blame other factors on my unhappy success rate. Bad owners, bad location, ugly clientele, crappy decor. I could live with that. I still had hope. My problem was the money. I was making too much of it. Instead of doing the smart thing, taking a massive pay cut to go to work for one of the now numerous emerging stars of American cooking, I continued my trajectory of working for a series of knuckleheaded, wacko, one-lung operations, usually already hemorrhaging when I arrived. Instead of running off to France or California or even uptown to work in one of the 3-star frog ponds as commis, the kind of Euro-style stage that helps build resumes and character, I chased the money. I was hooked on a chef-sized paycheck and increasing dosages of heroin. I was condemned to become Mr. Traveling Fix-It, always arriving after a first chef had screwed things up horribly, the wolves already at the door. I was more of an undertaker than a doctor. I don't think I ever saved a single patient. They were terminal when I arrived. I might at best have only prolonged their death throes. Having only recently achieved my dream of becoming a chef, I disappeared into the wilderness, feeding on the expiring dreams of a succession of misguided souls, a hungry ghost yearning for money and drugs. Apocalypse Now. They were assembling machine guns for sale in the employee bathroom when I arrived. All the line cooks were hunched over Armalites and M16s, while outside in the nearly unmanned kitchen, orders spewed out of the chattering printer and were ignored. Let's Call It Gino's was a gigantic 2-story northern Italian place on the waterfront, and the latest, most foolish venture from a guy everyone called the Silver Shadow, named for his Rolls Royce and the fact that he never spent more than 3 or 4 minutes in any one of his restaurants. When I walked in the door, it was like the Dolung Bridge scene in Apocalypse Now, where Martin Sheen shows up in the middle of a firefight, Hendrix blaring in the background, and inquires of a soldier, "Where's your CO?" To which the soldier replies, "Ain't you?" Nobody knew who was in charge, what was going on, who was ordering the food, or what was going to happen next. It was a big, expensive, and crowded asylum run almost entirely by the inmates. Money flowed in, God knows it was busy enough, and money flowed out. But where? No one seemed to have any idea, least of all the Silver Shadow. Gino's and its sister restaurant in Baltimore were classic don't-let-this-happen-to-you examples of overreaching by a successful restaurateur. The Silver Shadow had expanded a profitable family provision business into a smoking-hot restaurant catering to the Upper East Side Mortimer's Elaine's Coco Pazzo crowd, spun that restaurant off into another restaurant next door with a well-liked Italian race car driver freeloader as frontman, and followed these successes with a string of high-quality places in the village and elsewhere. It had seemed, for a while, as if he could do no wrong. He was hiring chefs by the bunch. My old friend Sammy already worked for him, and he'd apparently asked Sammy, "Do you know any more like you?" And Sammy had said, "Sure," which is how I, and eventually Dimitri, got involved in one of the biggest, ugliest train wrecks of an organization in the history of New York. The Silver Shadow couldn't keep track. Gino's New York, two kitchens, two dining rooms, outdoor cafe, and 300 seats, opened on the waterfront nearly simultaneously with its slightly smaller sister in Baltimore's Harbor Place. Plans were underway for more of them in Boston, New Orleans, and elsewhere. It was big 80s time with all that implied. Too much money, too much coke, both in the hands of hyperactive, overconfident, yuppie businessmen and investors, and at Gino's it reached critical mass. The Shadow seemed to start up a new enterprise every other day. In the food court across the way from Gino's, he opened a gelato shop and a thin-crust pizzeria, then zipped off to Italy to buy warehouses full of plates, flatware, gelato bases, furnishings, and then forgot where he put them. Chefs, managers, sous-chefs, partners rotated in and out with no rhyme or reason to their comings and goings. There were always a few chefs in the pipeline, shacked up in hotels, on full salary, waiting for the call to tell them where to go. The Silver Shadow bought chefs the way most people buy TV Guide at the supermarket, an impulse buy at the register after they do their real shopping. I had been hired, typically of the Silver Shadow, on impulse, and immediately tasked to take over, let's call it Dexter's, his relatively small American bistro on the Upper East Side. "They really need you over there," crowed the Shadow enthusiastically. "They're really looking forward to meeting you." So I quit the Columbus Avenue pickup joint I'd been working and hustled over to Dexter's. They had, it turned out, no idea I was coming. Worse, Dexter's and the Shadow's other restaurant, a northern Italian place next door, shared the same kitchen and the same chef and crew. There were simply two different kitchen doors leading to two different dining rooms. The chef, a mincing, freakish-looking albino, was apparently quite capably taking care of business without me, and he let me know so immediately. After grudgingly introducing me to the kitchen crew, who, it was immediately clear, held him in high regard, he took me aside and said, "I don't care what the Shadow fucking told you, this is my kitchen, and you ain't doing nothing more than picking spinach here as long as I'm here, which is forever." No way was I going to be stuck in a corner in a hostile kitchen working under this geek. I'd been promised a chef's job, my own kitchen with all that implied, and the idea of two chefs sharing responsibility for one crew was ridiculous, even if the albino had been willing. And I didn't care to pick spinach, even for $1,000 a week. I left immediately, calling the Shadow from a payphone. "What have you done to me?" I inquired, pissed off. "They'd rather rub shit in their hair over here than let me in. You have a chef already." "No problem," replied the Shadow, as if he just now remembered that the two restaurants shared a kitchen. "They really need you in Baltimore. Go down to Gino's on the waterfront. See the GM. He'll fill you in and give you some expense money." Which is how I found myself on the turbo liner to Baltimore, junk sick, confused, with an overnight bag and no idea of my mission. Baltimore sucks. If you haven't been there, it's a fairly quaint excuse for a city. At the time I was there, it was undergoing massive rehabilitation. An entire neighborhood by the waterfront was being restored into a sort of red brick and cobblestone theme park. Bars close at 1 a.m. They start flashing the lights for last call at 12:30. The permanent residents speak of New York and D.C. with strangely wistful expressions on their faces, as if they can't understand how they ended up here, rather than a few miles away north or south, where there's a real city. There's an element of the South, an almost rural quality to Baltimore, an Ozark fatalism that's amusing in John Waters' films, but not so much fun to live with. Worst of all, I had no idea where to score drugs. Gino's Baltimore occupied the second floor of a large new structure on the water in Baltimore's Harbor Place. The kitchen was bigger than the dining room, which I liked, but the dining room was pretty much empty most times, which I didn't like so much. The crew, not uncommonly for most far-flung outposts in a restaurant empire, were already used to being the neglected bastard offspring, largely ignored by their leader. Supplies, which were supposed to arrive from New York, were sporadic. Guidance, such as it was erratic in the extreme. I was told immediately that another chef had just preceded me. He had set up a menu, showed the recent culinary graduate cooks how to dunk pasta, and then quit. My first night I slept in a vacationing waiter's apartment. It was a strange bed with a strange cat and a shabby two-family Victorian. I lay awake kicking and scratching, swatting the cat at my feet. The next day I was brought over to the official residence of visiting dignitaries from New York, a three-story townhouse, brand new but built to look old, in the center of the fake historical district. It was pretty swank. Wall-to-wall carpeting, four bathrooms, vast dining room, living room, and top-floor studio. The only problem was there was no furniture. A bare futon lay in the middle of the floor on the third story, a pathetic black-and-white TV with coat-hanger antenna the only offered amusement. The spacious kitchen contained only some calcified rice cakes. The only other sign that anyone had ever lived there was a lone chef's jacket on a hanger in one of the closets, like an artifact, evidence of an ancient astronaut who'd been here before me. It was make-work, and I knew it. The shadow called to let me know that he wanted me to create a brunch menu and a happy hour buffet. This was an easy enough assignment, as there were only about 3 bar customers who spent their evening chatting with the manager, and brunch, such as it was, consisted of about 5 tables of Sunday tourists who'd wandered into the empty dining room by mistake while window shopping and been too embarrassed to leave after realizing their mistake. The place had been open only a few months and already gave off the distinct odor of doom. Large-scale doom. There were 12 cooks, all new equipment, a bake shop, a pasta-making department. The Silver Shadow had spent millions on this colossal monument to hubris and cocaine, and you could see in the cooks' faces that they knew, as sure as they knew that they lived in a second-class city, that they'd be out of work soon. The body was dying, only the brain had yet to receive the message. I worked fast, spending a lot of time shuttling back and forth to New York to score and bombed out shooting galleries on the Lower East Side. My pay had never been arranged properly. When I needed money, I simply asked the GM to give me a few hundred, which he seemed happy to do, as money bled quickly out of Gino's every orifice. There was no business at the restaurant, so there was soon nothing to do. When I couldn't make it back to the real city, I'd drink at the Club Charles, an atmospherically crappy dive with a vaguely punk rock clientele, or watch TV in my lonely room with a view. I passed the Baltimore job to Dimitri as soon as I could. Maybe it wasn't the nicest thing I ever did, but it was a chef's job, and the money was good, and hey, room and board was free. Once again, I called the Shadow, told him there was nothing for me to do, and was told in response, "They need you in New York. Get right back. They're really looking forward to meeting you," which is how I found myself in a bathroom full of machine guns. Gino's New York, unlike its little brother in Baltimore, was still busy, crazy busy, and in every way an out-of-control madhouse. If I wasn't already a burnt-out case from 4 years of drug abuse and 2 years in a Columbus Avenue pickup joint and the cumulative effects of my whole checkered career to this point, I was after Gino's. Gino's finished me. Brought in as the chef to replace the man whose jacket I'd discovered in Baltimore, I was shocked, even I was shocked, at the level of debauchery and open criminality. On my first day in Gino's New York, I found that the extremely well-paid head of prep could not so much as peel an onion when he deigned to show up at work at all. When I inquired, I was matter-of-factly informed by the New York GM that he was the boss's coke dealer, kept around so that the boss and upper management could conveniently re-up if their little screw-top bottles ran empty. The GM, a jangly, untrustworthy character who seemed to be high on Quaaludes most of the time, would disappear on benders for days at a time. This was problematic, as he had the only keys to the office. When the local wise guys showed up, as they did every Tuesday, looking for protection money, this kept our delivery trucks from having their tires slashed, we had to jimmy the office door to get at the safe. When no one with the combination was around, the assistant manager would simply ask the service bartender for a loan of a few thousand. He was always good for a few grand, as he did a bang-up business dealing coke to the employees. A quick review of the schedule and time cards for my mammoth kitchen staff revealed more than a few irregularities. Juan Rodriguez, sauté man, for instance, had been punching in as Juan Martinez, Juan Garcia, and Juan Perez, all of whom were imaginary creations the front office had been kind enough to keep paying, in spite of the fact that they clearly did not exist. If half the cooks were on the line when they were supposed to be, as opposed to selling guns or hiding in a stairwell smoking weed or cooking up freebase in a bathroom, it was a good thing. Expediting was done by whoever happened to be in the kitchen at the time. Food for Baltimore was trucked into our walk-ins, rotated into our stocks, then shipped out, such as it was, the next day. We made our own pasta, sometimes. We also bought pasta from our other stores. We bought pasta from outside, often all three at once. Gigantic steam kettles simmered with gorgonzola and garlic cream for our very popular garlic bread, $8 for a baguette and some goo, and herds of sightseers, tourists, businessmen, gawkers, rubes, and hungry fanny packers poured through the doors. The food was not bad. God knows we had enough cooks, plenty of equipment, and room to put it. Somehow things got done, though I have no idea how. The place had its own momentum, like some rudderless ocean liner, captain and crew long gone. It just kept going, plowing through ice fields. Someone with a brain had designed the line, a sensible trough of water for pasta with cute fitted baskets, ran the length of the range tops for easy dunking. Nice refrigerated bains held garnishes and mise en place so that each cook had an artist's palette of easy access ingredients at hand. Downstairs, a long bar curled around the dining room, serving a lighter menu of trattoria items, sandwiches, quick-grilled foods, cheese, shellfish. Outside, when it was warm, a long barbecue grill serviced the cafe. I fine-tuned the menu, meeting with the Shadow for a few minutes a day, satisfying him by simply responding to his culinary whims. Bagna cauda? I can do that, no problem. Clams arreganata? Why not? I had no delusions of chefly integrity or personal agenda where Italian menu items were concerned, so I was relatively responsive compared to my mysterious predecessor, and the Shadow seemed happy with me. In fact, after people started asking me in hushed voices what the Shadow thinks of this and what the Shadow thinks of that, I realized that the 3 or 4 minutes a day I spent talking to him made me, in the eyes of everyone else in the organization, his closest associate, though I couldn't have told them, if asked, what shade his eyes were or anything else. With 6 different things going on, the man was a blur, like Patty Hearst in those security camera photos from the bank job, perpetually in motion, always on the way out the door. I wasn't really very good at Italian food. I relied on Dimitri for most of my recipes, though his experience at Mario's was almost entirely Southern Italian red sauce and the like. But I got by nodding at whatever high concept the Shadow had a hot nut for that week, my real value to the organization becoming apparent after I had finally had enough and cut loose the coke-dealing head of prep. The Shadow and upper management were impressed by this. It showed frugality. The man was dead wood, after all. He'd been absent from work without explanation 2 Saturdays in a row, and truth be told, he couldn't cook at all. I'd shown balls, too, firing their coke dealer, and they kind of liked that. They couldn't have done it, as the bastard knew too much, and I'd shown real talent and diplomatic skill in the way I'd done the deed. The already financially comfortable prep chef was easily convinced that this showing up at the restaurant thing was an inconvenience and a distraction from his real calling, and that he'd be happier reverting to his former lifestyle, scooting around New York's bars and nightclubs in expensive Italian automobiles selling drugs. When I sorted out the Rodriguez-Garcia-Perez problem, unloaded a couple of wise-ass slacker waitrons, and replaced some no-show cooks with loyalists from Tom's and Work Progress, the Shadow saw in me my real calling, which was hatchet man. Not that I was happy with this mantle. But I was off dope now, and comfortably sedated by methadone, I felt free to visit the service bar numerous times a night so that I could pack my nose with cocaine. This gave me that lovably psychotic edge so useful for mood swings, erratic bursts of rage, and the serious business of canning people, thus saving my master money. Every day I'd wake up, lounge around in bed for a while, come into work, where service was already on automatic full swing, and look around for someone to fire. I had really no other responsibility. Supplies were ordered by a steward. The cook served the food the same way they'd always done. Expediting was done by committee, although I did it now and then. I scheduled, hired, and fired, and as we were greatly overstaffed, it was mostly the latter. But I was not happy in my work. Every day, having to look in some desperate cookie's eyes and tell him no mas trabajo aquí was taking a toll, especially when they'd ask why. White boys were no problem. I could bang out these goofballs all day. They knew anyway. They'd been expecting it, amazed that they hadn't been canned earlier. But the Mexicans and Ecuadorans and Salvadorans and Latinos who'd look at me with moist eyes as they realized that there'd be no check next week or the week after, when they asked that terrible question, por qué, why, chef, no work for me, as if maybe they'd heard it wrong. This was really grinding me down, tearing at what was left of my conscience. Every day I'd stay in bed later and later, paralyzed with guilt and self-loathing, hoping that if I stayed in bed a little later, showed up a little later, maybe, just maybe, it would be me that got fired this time, that I wouldn't have to do this anymore, that this whole terrible business would end. It didn't. Things only got worse. Pleased by my cost-cutting, the Shadow and his minions urged me on to even greater efforts. When I finally had to start messing around with some loyalist schedules, giving them split shifts for no additional money, and I saw the terrible look of betrayal in their eyes, guys who'd come up with me, some Egyptian cooks I trained from dishwasher, I could take no more. One day I simply turned to the GM and said, I quit, and it was over. I slept for 3 weeks. When I woke up, I was determined never again to be a chef. I'd cook. I had to make money. But I would never again be a leader of men. I would never again carry a clipboard, betray an old comrade, fire another living soul. I left none too soon. Gino's, in the end, dragged down the entire Silver Shadow empire, bankrupting even the family provisions business. Last I heard of the Shadow, he was doing time in federal lockup for tax evasion. I was about to enter the wilderness. The wilderness years. It is one of the central ironies of my career that as soon as I got off heroin, things started getting really bad. High on dope, I was, prior to Gino's, at least a chef, well-paid, much-liked by crew and floor and owners alike. Stabilized on methadone, I became nearly unemployable by polite society, a shiftless, untrustworthy, coke-sniffer, sneak thief, and corner-cutting hack, toiling in obscurity in the culinary backwaters. I worked mostly as a cook, moving from place to place, often working under an alias. I worked a seedy hotel on Upper Madison, a place so slow that the one waiter would have to come downstairs and wake me when customers came in. I was the lone cook, my only companion, the hotel super, and a gimpy dishwasher. I worked the lunch counter on Amsterdam, flipping pancakes and doing short-order eggs for Democratic politicos and their bagmen. I worked a bizarre combination art gallery bistro in Columbus, just me and a coke-dealing bartender, a typically convenient and destructive symbiotic arrangement. I was a sous chef at a very fine two-star place on 39th, where I dimly recall preparing a four-course meal for Paul Bocuse. He thanked me in French, I think. My brain at this point was shriveled by cocaine, and I made the mistake of telling a garde-manger man that if he didn't hurry up with an order, I'd tear his eyes out and skull-fuck him, which did not endear me to the fussy owner-manager. I worked a deserted crab house on 2nd Avenue, steaming blue crabs and frying crab cakes. I cooked brunches in Soho. I slapped out steam table chow at a bar on 8th Street to a bunch of drunks. For a time, I took another chef's job, of sorts, at a moment of need at Billy's, a combo sit-down take-out upscale chicken joint on Bleecker Street. It was an operation that was to be the flagship of another planned empire, a chain of chicken joints that would stretch across the globe. At this low point in my career, I didn't care if the place succeeded or not. I needed the money. My boss was an older Jewish guy, fresh out of prison, who'd named the place after his youngest son, Billy, a feckless ne'er-do-well. He had been, in an earlier life, the head of the counting room at a Las Vegas casino, and after being caught skimming off millions for the boys back in New York and Cincinnati, had been offered a friendly deal should he cooperate with the prosecutors. He had, admirably, declined, and as a result spent the last 5 years eating prison chow. When he got out, a near-broken man, his old buddies in New York, being men of honor, set him up with his restaurant, with promises of more to come, as a sign of gratitude for services rendered. Unfortunately, while in prison, the old man had completely lost his mind. He may have been a stand-up guy, but he was absolutely barking mad. This was not a classic bust-out operation where the mob deliberately runs a place into the ground using a front-man straw owner to run up bills then pillage the place for merchandise and credit. I think that the wise guys, who from the early days of startup were always around, really wanted the poor slob to make money and be a success. They made earnest efforts to help at every turn, enduring much nonsense from their visibly deranged partner. It was, in retrospect, a useful experience for me, one I relied on for later works of fiction. I'd seen mobsters around before, of course, but I'd never worked in a place that was out-and-out mobbed up, where I came to know on a personal basis real wise guys whose names I recognized from the papers. Everyone was astonishingly upfront about their connections. My boss was fond of yelling into the phone when discussing prices with a purveyor. You know who I am? You know who I'm with? We did things differently at Billy's. My cooks, for one. Every one of them came from the Fortune Society, guys who spent their off hours in halfway houses, allowed out only to work. I was used to working with a fairly rough bunch, a lot of whom at one time or another had problems with the law. But at Billy's, every single one of my cooks was still basically a convict. I can't say that it was an unhappy arrangement either, for once I knew my cooks were going to show up at work every day. If they didn't, they went back to prison. And credit was easily obtained. I knew from previous experience how difficult it is to set up terms for a new restaurant. Even getting a week's credit with some of these companies was usually a lengthy process involving credit applications, a long wait, initial periods of cash on delivery. At Billy's, no sooner was I off the phone than stuff was arriving, often on 60-day terms. Produce and dry goods people who'd been loath to offer even 2 weeks at other places I'd worked were suddenly all too happy to give me all the time I wanted. My boss spent a lot of time on the phone investigating the serious business of horses and their bloodlines and how well they ran in mud or on grass. Billy himself, at 18, was happy to drive his sports car around and chase girls. So my day-to-day was spent mostly with some genial gentlemen from an Italian fraternal organization. They helpfully told me where to buy my meat and poultry and how to meet the folks who would be supplying my linen, bread, paper goods, and so on. I had a lot of meetings in cars. The bread guy is here, I'd be told. And a late-model Buick would pull up out front. An old guy in a mashed-down golf cap would beckon me from the driver's seat and then get out of the car. The older guy in the passenger seat would slide over, indicating he wanted me to get in, sit next to him, and talk. We'd sit there in the idling car, talking cryptically about bread, before he brought me around to the trunk to examine some product. It was a strange business. Yet some things were off-limits. Trash removal, I found, was a mysteriously prearranged division of labor. When I called around for price quotes, told them who I was calling for, I was repeatedly quoted prices far exceeding the national debt, until I called the company I'd obviously been intended to do business with. Oh, yeah, Billy, said the voice on the phone. I was waiting for you to call. And quoted me a very reasonable price. I rang up a meat company inquiring if they'd care to sell me tens of thousands of dollars of burger patties a year, and they gave me a flat no. They wouldn't even quote me prices. I was confused by this until years later when I read a Paul Castellano biography called Boss of Bosses and recognized the name of the meat company as a business operated by another family. And there was the chicken guy, who also met me in a car and showed me samples in a trunk. When I introduced him to my boss, the old man bitched about the price, telling the chicken guy in his blood-smeared white butcher's coat that the price was too high, that he could just fly to fucking Virginia, buy the stuff direct. And do you know who I'm with anyway? The chicken guy was not impressed. He spat on the floor, looked my boss in the eye, and said, fuck you, asshole. You know who I'm with? You can fly to fucking Virginia and buy direct all you want. You still gonna pay me. Frank fucking Perdue pays me, asshole, and you're gonna pay me too. My boss was suitably chastened for a time. But he got wackier and wackier. When we finally opened, we were packed from the first minute. Orders flooded in over the phone and at the counter and at the tables. We were unprepared and understaffed, so the Italian contingent, including various visiting dignitaries, all with oddly anglicized names, this is Mr. D, Tony, and meet a friend, Mr. Brown, this is Mr. Lang, all of them overweight, cigar-chomping, middle-aged guys with bodyguards and $10,000 watches, pitched in to help out with deliveries and at the counter. Guys I'd read about later in the papers as running construction in the outer boroughs, purported killers, made men who lived in concrete piles on Staten Island and Long Beach and security-fenced estates in Jersey, carried brown paper bags of chicken sandwiches up three flights of stairs to Greenwich Village walk-up apartments to make deliveries. They slathered mayo and avocado slices on pita bread behind the counter and bussed tables in the dining room. I have to say, I liked them for that. But when my boss inexplicably showed up one day and told me to fire everyone with a tattoo on my staff, I was faced with a dilemma. Every one of my cooks was festooned with prison tats, screaming skulls, Jesus on hypodermic crosses, bound in barbed wire, gang tats, flaming dice, swastikas, SS flashes, born to lose, born dead, born to raise hell, love, hate, mom, portraits of the Madonna, wives, girlfriends, Ozzy Osbourne. I tried to put him off, explaining that we couldn't do without these guys, that the hardest working, most indispensable guy we had, the guy who right now was loading trash cans with hundreds of marinating chicken parts in the cramped, stifling, unrefrigerated cellar on his 22nd consecutive double shift, he was a goddamn Sistine Chapel of skin art. And where am I going to find a convict without a tattoo? The Watergate burglars weren't, to my knowledge, available. Things only got worse. He came in the next day obsessing about gold chains and jewelry. My grill man had the usual ghetto adornments of the day. Where do you think that eggplant got all that gold, he raved, spraying food and saliva as he talked. Selling drugs, that shit is poison, mugging old ladies, I don't want that in my restaurant, get him out. This was clearly impossible, and I sought counsel with one of the silent partners, who, as my boss had become increasingly distracted and unpredictable, had grown noticeably less silent. He and his associates had started to attend the management meetings. You hear what he wants me to do, I asked. The man just nodded and rolled his eyes sympathetically, I thought. Do nothing, he said. And then with truly dangerous intonation added, aspet, meaning wait in Italian. I didn't like the sound of that at all. He smiled at me, and I couldn't help picturing my boss slumped over a dashboard after one of those meetings in a car they were all so fond of. When things came to a head a few days later, my boss openly screaming in the middle of a crowded dining room that he wanted all the tattooed guys and gold chain wearers out now, I told him to pay me what he owed, I was leaving for good. He refused. The silent partner came over, peeled off my pay and an extra $100 from a fat roll in his suit pocket, and gave me a warm smile as he bade me goodbye. I don't know what happened to Billy's. It certainly never developed into a worldwide chain as my crazed boss had envisioned, or even a second store. The next time I was in the neighborhood, a picture framer occupied the space where the restaurant had been. What happened to the old man and his dreams of a poultry empire for his son? I can only guess. I worked at a Mexican restaurant on Upper 2nd Avenue for a while, one of those places on the frat boy strip with the obligatory margarita snow cone machine grinding away all night and vomit running ankle deep in the gutters outside. The place was owned by a very aggressive rat population, fattened up and emboldened by the easily obtained stacks of avocados left to ripen outside the walk-in each night. They ran over our feet in the kitchen, hopped out of the garbage when you approached, and worst of all, stashed their leavings in the walls and ceilings. Every once in a while, the soggy acoustic tile ceilings would crumble and moist avalanches of avocado pits, chewed chicken bones, and half-eaten potatoes would come tumbling out onto our heads. I was reaching rock bottom, both personally and professionally. I got canned from the Mexican place, for which particular reason I don't know. There were plenty of good ones. Alcoholism, drug abuse, pilferage, laziness. I don't know which of these unlovely traits actually did me in. But I didn't mind. The rats were really bugging me, especially when I was high on coke, which was most of the time. I worked in an all-Chinese kitchen for a time, squatting on the floor with my fellow cooks, sharing their simple staff meals of rice gruel, pork broth, and fish bones each day, shoveling in my food with chopsticks and betting on how many plum tomatoes would be in a case in the day's delivery. I cracked oysters at a shellfish bar, watching as drunken customers gobbled jumbo shrimps without bothering to remove the shells, so pickled from booze they were beyond caring. I came to know actors, loan sharks, enforcers, car thieves, guys who sold false ID, phone scammers, porno stars, and a dope fiend hostess who attended mortician school during the day. She came up to me one night at the shellfish bar, a blissed out look on her face, and said, "We did a baby today in school, and it, like, aspirated in my arms, man. You could hear it sigh when I pick it up." She looked happy about this. She had a fetish for Con Ed workers, something about the uniforms, I guess, and whenever they were doing electrical work or repairing a gas line in her neighborhood, she'd come in the next day singing the praises of the fine folks who kept our utilities running. I got to know a steely-eyed Irish hood in his 50s who worked with the pressman's union sometimes. When he had a big tune-up scheduled, he'd recruit other regulars from the bar.